It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up later, we'll hear about the economic cost of empty storefronts in downtowns all over Wisconsin. First, now that we're past the 4th of July and in the thick of the season, we want to know, what are you reading this summer? Call in now at 800-642-1234 with your summer reading list. Summer reading, it's a tradition that starts in elementary school, trying to keep kids engaged over the summer when school's out, avoid that summer learning loss. Evolves into beach reading when we're adults. For some people, summer is an excuse to read something easy, fun, maybe even forgettable. For other people, these long, warm days are the chance to catch up on the list of books we've been meaning to read all year. So we're asking you, what are you reading this summer? What have you already read? Do you have a philosophy of summer reading? What makes a great summer book? How do you choose what you're going to read maybe on the summer vacation? Call with your suggestions, your book reviews, your reading ambitions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. I've got one. I don't usually think of summer reading as a distinct thing, but I had a really good one. Allison Weir, W-E-I-R, possibly Weir, should have looked it up probably, read a book called Innocent Traitor. It's historical fiction. I usually like history. I like fiction. Don't usually read historical fiction. This is great. It's about Lady Jane Grey, one of the possible heirs to Henry VIII. It goes wives 3 through 6 during Henry VIII's reign. Really good page-turner, fun, light read, but also, not fun. I mean, bad things happen. Spoiler alert. It ends poorly. But it also gives a really good taste of history. And the great thing for me is it turns out she's written a lot of other fiction and actual history books, like popular history books, too. So Allison Weir, my first suggestion for today on some summer reading. Now we'll go to you, 800-642-1234. We've got Mike on the line in Dalton. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hey.
What do you got for us, Mike?
I am rolling through the book called What Stands in a Storm. I can't tell you the name of the author off the top of my head. It's about the horrific outbreak of tornadoes in 2011 that rolled across Mississippi through Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Ooh. Very science and meteorology intensive. Fascinating read. Makes me terrified to ever travel below a Mason-Dixon line.
Yeah, we're completely safe from tornadoes here, Mike. Oh, no, wait. So this is, it's nonfiction, though, but it's telling the story of how this happened, why this outbreak happened, and what it did?
Yeah, she tells the story from the vantage point of different people that lived through it, some that did not live through it, pulling up their text messages, Facebook statuses as the storm's progressing, and goes very deeply into various meteorologists, storm chasers, and their communications back and forth. I mean, it's fascinating enough to have 300 pages where you can't put the book down.
Wow. What Stands in a Storm. Mike, thank you so much for sharing that. We'll go now to Jamie in Eau Claire. Jamie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to recommend The Power of One. It's about starts out with a young boy who is living in Africa, and he's 5 years old, and that's where the story starts with his life, and his life takes him from mining and archaeological things and gardening things. I mean, his whole, and even fighting, boxing, and it's a wonderful, wonderful read, and the writer just, it reads really easily, it reads fast, and yet it's a really good read.
The Power of One. And this is one that has been a good summer read for you, Jamie?
Yes. One of the ones that I've read this summer, yep.
Jamie, thank you so much for sharing that. We're asking for your summer reading suggestions or summer reading ambitions. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We asked around here at work. Rachel in the copy room said she and her 7 roommates are all in different cities this summer, so they've set up a book race judged by the number of books read and the number of pages reading this summer. She says, personally, I plan to work through the books I've borrowed from work for the rest of the summer. The consensus is that action-packed thrillers make for the best summer reads. So that sounds great. A book race for the summer. I'm probably not going to do that, but more power to anybody who does. Back to our callers now. Matthew on the line in Superior. Matthew, hi.
Hi. Well, there's this book called Whiskers Travels Wisconsin. It's about a cat that travels from Superior to the state capital in Madison. Along the way, discovers the state bird in Wisconsin and the state flag and the state symbol and the state motto and all these things about Wisconsin. It's written by Sylvia Oberle in Thorpe, Wisconsin. She's a retired school teacher. And it's all about Wisconsin and this cat that finds his way through the state.
Okay, and as we follow Whiskers around, we learn more about our state, it sounds like.
Exactly, yeah, and it's a really good book.
That sounds like fun, Matthew. Thanks so much for sharing a little local product there, Whiskers Travels Wisconsin. We heard from Kathleen Dunn, show producer Scotty, who says, with the added leisure time of summer, I'm going to return to a hefty classic, that windmill chaser Don Quixote. It's written in the 17th century, he writes, but I swear it reads like a Mel Brooks movie script. Don Quixote. Okay, a little more serious reading there for the summer. You can share your summer reading at 800-642-1234. Frank is with us next in Burlington. Frank, hi.
Hi there. I've read and plowed through the really long book Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand about Louis Zamperini. I was sucked in from all the movie hype from the book being made into a movie, and last day of school I found it in our school library, grabbed it off the shelf, and couldn't put it down.
And I haven't read this or seen the movie, Frank, but as I understand it, this guy's life, if I'd written it and said, hey, this is fiction, everybody would have said, this is outrageous. No way, that would never happen in a person's life. But it's a true story.
Absolutely. And it was phenomenal. The story was just unreal. What the World War II veterans, POWs, went through absolutely blew my mind. I just couldn't imagine the pain and anguish that these men went through, and it was a great book. So my mom has my copy now. So
you're loaning it around. Great, Frank. Thank you so much for the suggestion. Elise is with us next in Madison. Elise, hi.
Hi. I was calling to recommend Farm City by Novella Carpenter. It was the funniest book I've read in a really long time, and I was able to read it in about 3 days. This woman, she moved to Oakland, California, and not to give away too many details, she goes on to lots of very hilarious urban farming adventures. And it's both realistic and motivating and just funny the whole way through.
Motivating? What did it motivate you to do some urban farming of your own, Elise?
Oh, I'd like to. It actually motivated a friend of mine who borrowed the book. She went ahead, took the leap, and got her urban chicken.
Okay. All right. So it actually motivated some behavior. Is it going to get you to get chickens or a bigger garden plot in the future, do you think?
Yes, I did sign up to get a garden plot. It was on my mind, and I went ahead and did it. In our household, we've made the agreement that I get the chickens when the kids are old enough to help me.
Sounds like a good plan, Elise. Thanks. The book is Farm City. Trina Anderson is with us now. Trina, hi.
Hi, I'm calling from Jefferson, and I want to recommend Hot Dogs and Hamburgers, Unlocking Life's Potential Through Literacy at Any Age. It's by Rob Schindler, and it is the Wisconsin Literacy Statewide Read this year. We're celebrating our 30th anniversary, and our 74 literacy councils around the state of Wisconsin are doing a statewide read around this book. And it's inspiring and funny and a really enjoyable summer read.
Well, it's a statewide read. You better tell us more about it. What is Hot Dogs and Hamburgers all about?
Well, Hot Dogs and Hamburgers is the story of Rob Schindler. So it's, like an autobiography where he's talking about trying to help his son who has dyslexia, and he's trying to figure out how to help him uncrack the code and read. And to do that, he starts volunteering at the Chicago Literacy Council. And through the process of becoming a literacy tutor, he learns how to assist his son. And it's actually really, really funny the way that it's written, a very enjoyable read. And as I mentioned, literacy councils all over the state of Wisconsin are going to be promoting this book throughout the summer and fall of this year. So be on the lookout for it.
So where, if people want to jump on board on this, do they go to the library, call their local literacy council?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
Both of those would be a great choice, absolutely. Or they could contact wisconsinliteracy.org, which is right in Madison.
All right.
We can hook you up.
Trina, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Thank you all for your calls and what you're reading this summer. Don't stop now, though. Keep sharing your summer reading suggestions and or ambitions over at the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up this week, the U.S. Senate and House are debating updated versions of No Child Left Behind. We'll talk to an education reporter about how these new bills could change education policy nationwide. First, for downtowns all over Wisconsin, there seems to be one common problem shared by cities and towns alike: empty storefronts. What could be a local business, maybe a restaurant, is too often just an empty space with the for rent sign up in the window. The problem is big enough that two Milwaukee organizations recently hosted an empty storefronts conference to tackle the issue. Our next guest says these empty storefronts aren't just eyesores, they're also significant economic losses for the communities they're part of. So what can be done to get tenants back in these storefronts and as a result, a steady flow of cash back into the community? Amy Greil is with us now. She's a community, natural resources, and economic development educator for the Kenosha County UW Extension. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yes, happy to be here.
So let's start with the basic question. Why do we see so many empty storefronts in Wisconsin communities and in downtowns around the country?
Well, we believe that it's a number of factors, but the preponderance of online shopping and certainly big box stores, convenience, retail, has really pulled development away from historic downtowns to larger parcels, to suburban development, and it's just been a really progressive movement away from some of our downtowns.
And you've been trying to tackle the question of what does this cost the community it's part of? So how do we start assessing that? What kind of economic impacts does that empty storefront on the square or on Main Street have?
Well, this figure that we kind of came up with of $76,200 annually was really it's a figure that we've came up with that is kind of speculative of a hypothetical business. So we figured that worker spending, residential spending, local business spending, utilities, property and sales tax all contribute to losses in the community. So we, as I say, kind of speculated what a hypothetical business in downtown Kenosha would create as far as economic impacts and came up with a figure that I think surprised a lot of people.
And is that an incentive then for local real estate developers, local city planners, community leadership to invest to try to bring that back, to try to get those empty storefronts filled up?
Absolutely. I think it's a real opportunity. Not only do empty storefronts contribute to a sense of isolation downtown and contributes to blight, but what they really are and what they present to communities is an opportunity for reuse. We know that successful revitalization of downtowns really comes on the back of historic preservation, and that preservation really does make economic sense. So, yeah, it's hopefully this conversation and these figures that we're throwing around really do spark some interest and bring people back to consider downtown real estate.
Talking to Amy Greil with UW Extension in Kenosha County about the impact of empty storefronts, the economic impact. It has a big price tag, not just for the person who owned the business that closed and the people who worked there, but the community as a whole. So let's talk about what can be done to take that building, maybe it's standing empty right now, Amy, and make it more appealing to potential customers, to get people downtown. And in a paper, you have a lot of before and after pictures of storefronts that have undergone some kind of change. What are some of the most common things that can be done to make these empty storefronts more appealing and get a tenant in them?
Well, very often it's work on the facade. So it may be removing slip covers and false facades that kind of obscure original windows, replacing windows with high-efficiency windows, tuck pointing, which really kind of improved the appearance of the building, washing the brick, painting, awnings. It really just kind of depends on what the original features of the building with what they are and what you can possibly do to oftentimes restore the natural features that were designed for that period.
Yeah, and you mentioned historic preservation, and you just made the point that it's important to reflect the character of that building. Why is that important?
Well, they were built with very high design standards. Many of these buildings are true gems of architecture and were used building materials that were specific to that era and in a style that is reflective of a certain period. So, yeah, it's very important to maintain our heritage in this way by preserving some of that natural design or that original design.
Is there, we hear about the broken windows theory of fighting crime. Is there something analogous here, kind of a contagion, if we start making these older, more rundown-looking buildings look better and more attractive? It leads other business owners, property owners to do the same, and you start to see this spread in a community?
Absolutely. We did see a catalytic effect of building renovations that when one building property owner renovated their properties, that others would see increased sales revenues and often find tenants if they were vacant. So there is a catalytic nature to some of this work in storefront improvements.
So even if you have a nicer looking building, if it's still empty, it's still an empty building. So is there something about tenant recruitment? Do communities have to go out and try to recruit businesses to fill these empty spots?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a full-time job working in a Main Street community, attracting businesses and really working to promote your community. We saw in Kenosha that a few of our empty storefronts were actually rehabbed by existing businesses that wanted to expand. So that's a really great kind of development down here that is happening as businesses grow and need more space and they can take on buildings that might be adjacent to them and rehab them in the process.
So who needs to be at the table to try to make this not just a one-off thing, but a policy, a goal for a downtown area?
There's a lot of interested and important stakeholders in this process. Certainly your local municipal officials, your elected officials, real estate brokers. We saw at the Milwaukee event there was such a cross-section of interested parties between property owners, business owners, downtown development, volunteers. I mean, it really runs the gamut, and you can see that the community really can rally behind buildings and really feels invested in the appearance of their downtown.
Can you share a success story or two at a building level or at a community level?
Yeah, we have a success story right here in our Kenosha downtown. It's called Fusion, and they took an old building that basically they had covered the hardwood floors and drywalled the original brick walls and really just kind of let the building fall into disrepair. And the current owner has just really been able to remove a lot of these modifications, and it is a tremendous space. Now it's used for performing arts, and they've installed some really high-quality sound systems and things like that. But it's a productive building that's really contributing to the economy and to the environment down here in Kenosha.
Now, you mentioned the challenges facing downtown economies. They've been building for a while. Internet shopping, big box stores, malls on the outskirts of town have been around for decades. Is there a hunger? Is there a market for downtowns if they're kept up, if they're maintained properly and offer some selection?
Absolutely. I think that we are moving into a generation, an era now that is really looking to reconnect with sort of its heritage, and the creative class is really driving a lot of the economic development that we're seeing these days. So returning to cities and sort of the urban cores of our communities is all of a sudden much more attractive. We can see that many times it's the artists that lead the way into these communities for the affordable housing, rents and things like that. But, you know, they really, it's not long before traditional audiences are all of a sudden moving in for the lifestyle and the cultural amenities. So, yeah, I think that there's a lot of opportunity for our downtowns today.
Very briefly, as we wrap up, you mentioned Kenosha, you mentioned the conference in Milwaukee. Do these lessons port well into smaller towns?
Absolutely. We saw in our study of 24 case studies around the state of Wisconsin that rural communities benefit as much or more economically from some of these renovation projects. So we found that there's great case studies throughout the state, rural and urban alike.
Amy, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you.
That was Amy Grile, Community Natural Resources and Economic Development Educator for the Kenosha County UW Extension, looking at the economic costs of empty storefronts in Wisconsin and what can be done to rehab them. Over at the Central Time Facebook page, we've got a link to a report that she and colleagues did with some interesting before and after pictures. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, smoke was in our weather forecast today. We'll find out why and if it's going to stick around. First, this week, Congress is debating No Child Left Behind, the federal bill passed in 2001 as a reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. It increased the federal role in public education and led to an increase in testing in public schools nationwide. That bill was supposed to be revisited in 2007, but it hasn't been updated for almost a decade. Legislators are finally working at a new version that could make big changes to federal education policy. Updated versions are in both the House and the Senate. Here to explain these different versions of the bill and visions of education, how it could change things around the country, is Allison Klein. She's a reporter for Education Week and the co-author of the blog Politics K-12. Allison, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get on the same page first. No Child Left Behind reauthorized the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, as we mentioned. What changed in national education policy when No Child Left Behind was signed into law back in 2002?
Well, a lot changed when No Child Left Behind was signed. First, while many states already had some sort of a system for rating schools and many states tested students, No Child Left Behind required every state to test their students, and it required every state to test them in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school in reading and math. It also required states to take action in schools that were not meeting achievement targets, which were just sort of goals that states set for student achievement. And schools that didn't meet these targets would have to let kids transfer to a better performing school. They had to offer free tutoring, or you know, if they really stayed, if they struggled for a really long time, they could even face state takeover. The problem was that the goals that No Child Left Behind set were really ambitious, and no state had all the schools meet those goals. So now, you know, we're way past the deadline when all students were supposed to reach the proficiency level on state tests that was supposed to be the 2013-14 school year. And the law is just really outdated and kind of a farce.
So why has it taken so long to get to where we are this week, taking a serious crack at revising it?
Well, that's mostly because Congress has just been very broken for the past, I guess, 8 years. You know, we've had in 2007, it looked like there was going to be some action around reauthorization, and there was disagreement between Republicans who wanted, they wanted to have seats back then, some more school choice. The Bush administration at the time, George W. Bush, was worried that bills under consideration would weaken accountability. And the National Education Association was worried about a small provision that was in a long ago bill that would require future evaluation based on test scores if states wanted to get or districts wanted to get federal grants. So there were just like lots of disagreements in 2007 when it looked like things could happen. And then we just had this broke down, polarized Congress between 2008 and now.
So, and that takes us to now, the House, the Senate, each considering versions of this bill to change No Child Left Behind. First of all, are they on the same page, or are we having pretty different visions in each chamber?
So they're not totally on different pages. Basically, the House bill and the Senate bill would both roll back on accountability provisions in No Child Left Behind and return a lot of control to states. Both bills would keep those tests in place that I talked about, the tests in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school. And both bills would get rid of a provision in the Obama administration's waivers. Wisconsin is one of the states that has a waiver that requires states to evaluate teachers based on test scores. They're on the same page on things like that. The House bill goes a bit further in rolling back the federal role than the Senate bill does, and it allows money for disadvantaged kids to follow kids to a school of their choice. And I know school choice is a really big issue in Wisconsin with your Milwaukee voucher program. So in the House bill, you could use federal funds to help finance that program, and that wouldn't be an option under the Senate bill.
Now, testing, standardized testing under No Child Left Behind has gotten protests from a lot of people across the political spectrum, really, and some districts have revolted to some extent over the years. Are we going to see any fewer tests as a result of the changes that that might happen here?
So that's a really good question. Right now, it doesn't look like there's going to be any real reduction in at least the number of tests that the federal government requires. So it would still be those tests in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school in math and reading, plus science tests during certain grades. That wouldn't change. Both bills do include language encouraging states and districts to take a look at the number of tests they offer and maybe cut that back. And there is a movement afoot in the House, which we'll consider this bill tomorrow, to pass an amendment that would basically allow parents to opt their children out of standardized tests without any problem or any blowback on the school. Right now, schools that have a lot of kids opting out face federal sanctions, and under this amendment, that wouldn't be the case anymore.
We're talking to Allison Klein with Education Week, looking at the No Child Left Behind Act, passed 13 years ago, getting an overdue look from Congress, supposed to be reviewed in 2007. Both chambers now reviewing different plans to change No Child Left Behind. You can join in with your thoughts and your questions, by the way, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. So in the Senate, is there anything unique on the Senate side that isn't in the House side that they're looking to change in No Child Left Behind?
Sure. Well, the Senate would include a new program to help states improve their preschool programs. That's sort of the most interesting difference between the House and the Senate bill in terms of something that's new. The Senate bill also continues funding for a lot of programs like after-school programs that the House would need to cut.
And let's get to the accountability issue. You touched on that a little bit. How much of a sticking point do you think that's going to be? If accountability is relaxed in any way, are there going to be people in the Senate, in the House, who push back?
Well, so both bills would relax accountability considerably, at least in terms of the federal law. So states would really have to be the ones to step up and decide if they want to do accountability themselves. The federal government wouldn't be making them anymore. That is the administration's biggest beef with both the House and Senate bill. So the administration is hoping that there will be changes to the Senate bill that would require states to identify their lowest performing schools, schools with really big achievement gaps, and schools with lots of kids dropping out, which the administration calls dropout factory. And then do something about those schools, try to help them turn around, help them succeed. Right now, the Obama administration's waivers require states to take those kinds of actions, but there aren't very many explicit provisions in the Senate bill that would allow for that. I think the administration would love to see the House pass language like that, too, but that's you know, that's a tall order with a Republican-controlled House.
And at different points along No Child Left Behind, and as some states have implemented it, the idea was that schools in that situation, high dropout rates, underperforming schools, would in some ways be punished and maybe changes required or more flexibility being given to students to get out of those schools. Are we still thinking along those lines in what's being reviewed this week?
So the House bill, as we talked about already, includes a provision that would allow federal money for low-income kids. That's a program called Title I. To follow kids to the school of their choice. But both of the bills would drop a requirement that calls for schools to allow kids that are stuck in schools that aren't meeting achievement targets to transfer to a better performing school. That's actually not as big a deal as it sounds like it is, because that requirement was already dropped under the Obama administration's waivers, which are in place in most states, including Wisconsin. So it's not, I guess, the bombshell that it would have been before the waivers came along.
We're talking to Allison Klein from Education Week, looking at updated versions of No Child Left Behind in the U.S. Senate and the House, how these new versions of the bill could change education policy in the United States. We want to hear from you on this. How would you like to see No Child Left Behind changed? What do you think could be done to make public education more effective in the U.S.? If you've been involved in the schools as a teacher, as a parent, as a community member, maybe somebody on the school board, how do you see No Child Left Behind affecting your school? In the long run and in recent years. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue this conversation after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our discussion about updates to No Child Left Behind, the federal education law. The Senate and the House are looking at revisions to No Child Left Behind this week. Allison Klein is with us. She's a reporter for Education Week. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the impact of No Child Left Behind? Teachers, how did this legislation change things in your classroom? What do you think needs to change? What questions do you have about what's at stake here? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller. We've got Kurt on the line in Milton. Kurt, hi.
Hello. My comment is, for years, it seems like I've heard from teachers, and I know a good number of them, and my parents were both elementary school teachers, and from school board staff that continually says that we have these wasteful spending required by No Child Left Behind. Things like kids who are, you know, troubled or not going to make it in the world, receiving, you know, one-on-one support, very expensive programs that my parents and teachers at NOM have said are just, you know, taking resources away from normal education.
Kurt, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Allison, is this a common complaint from schools that this is requiring a lot of unnecessary spending? No Child Left Behind is.
So that's a really good question. As I mentioned before, No Child Left Behind required schools that didn't make progress for 3 years in a row to offer free tutoring, which is what I think the caller was referring to, these sort of expensive one-on-one services. And a lot of these tutoring programs were really ineffective. We don't actually need a reauthorization of No Child Left Behind to change that, because that was already changed under the Obama administration's waivers. So right now, most states don't have to set aside money for tutoring. But states that don't have waivers, and there are eight of them out there, including Iowa, California, some other big states, you know, they do have to continue to set aside those funds. So obviously this is a really big issue for them, but not necessarily for Wisconsin.
Thanks a lot for the call, Kurt. Another issue that's come up, funding for rural school districts. Advocates for those districts say current funding formulas shortchange rural schools. This is an issue in our complicated funding formula here in Wisconsin as well. Is that something on the table here, Allison?
Yes. Senator Burr is expected to try to push for changes to the funding formula for Title I, which is the formula that governs money for disadvantaged students. And it does, in some cases, shortchange rural schools because it's based on population density. It's been really hard to change the Title I formula because, you know, every lawmaker kind of has a stake in it, and Congress doesn't really have any extra money to kind of gradually shift money from one state or district and bring it to another. So we'll have to see how all that turns out.
Back to our callers now with Stephanie in Moline, Illinois. Stephanie, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Stephanie?
I am a school administrator in Moline, Illinois. I'm the director of ESL and Bilingual Services. We are very fortunate in our district to have 800 English language learners. But under the testing requirements of No Child Left Behind, they are supposed to be reading at grade level after 1 year of schooling in the United States in English. We are not failing our kids. It takes between 3 and 8 years, depending on former schooling, for somebody to read and write and be academically at grade level. And my students are not failing, and neither are my teachers.
Stephanie, thanks a lot for the call. This has been a complaint about No Child Left Behind, I think, since the beginning, Allison, that these expectations are there for performance from students who, for a variety of reasons, including they're just now learning English, it's a tall order to get them there.
Yeah, no, it's definitely been something that states and school administrators, like the caller, have been worried about. And it's been an issue with some amendments offered to these bills to try to change that, and we'll just have to see what comes out in the final version. Meanwhile, I mentioned those waivers. A couple of states, including Florida, especially Florida, have already gotten some flexibility in this area. So we'll see if more states do and if this eventual federal law, a new law, would allow for more flexibility there.
Now, one issue I understand has come in and out in amendment form is provisions related to bullying in the No Child Left Behind Act. What's the story there?
So Senator Al Franken and Senator Bob Casey have been working on amendments that deal with bullying of lesbian, bisexual, gay, and transgender students. It's obviously kind of a hot topic right now, given what the Supreme Court just decided on same-sex marriage. So sounds like they're going to offer something during consideration of this bill. And we'll see if that ends up being a really divisive issue on the floor.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, Congress has had a hard time tackling not just education, but a number of issues. It's a contentious time in Congress, same as always lately, it seems like. What are the prospects for successful passage of a bill that's going to pass the Senate and the House and then get signed by the president?
So it's really hard to say, right? It's I've talked to some folks who put the chances at about 50-50, some people who are more optimistic and would say, you know, 60-40. So I would say the safe thing to say is that we have the best shot that we've had since 2007 when this law was up for reauthorization, but it's really far from a slam dunk.
And what's the timeline now? I know this is being considered in the Senate and in the House. Do they have plans for when it moves out of committee, when it gets a vote in the full chambers?
Well, so it actually has already moved out of committee. It is getting a vote in the full chambers right now. It's scheduled to go to the House floor tomorrow, and Senate started debate today. So we will just have to, we'll have to see. The House should be able to finish the bill tomorrow because they already started on it back in February and had to pull it temporarily due to conservative opposition. But apparently those issues have been taken care of and it's expected to pass. And it should be off the Senate floor by early next week. That's when the leaders, the sponsors of the bill, have said that they'll get it off the Senate floor. So that's basically the state of play as of right now.
Allison, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Sure. Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Allison Klein, reporter for Education Week and co-author of the blog Politics K-12. She was with us to talk about the updated versions of No Child Left Behind being debated in the U.S. House and Senate this week. Short circuit this, please. That's what members of a group that fights utility rate increases are hoping happens to a provision in the state budget plan. The change could weaken opposition to power company price hikes, and advocates are hoping lawmakers or Governor Walker will change it in the final version. Chuck Kornbach reports that the governor isn't saying what he'd do if the language reaches his desk.
Walker didn't include in his budget proposal the cutting of a competitive PSE grant of up to $300,000 in utility ratepayer money that for 5 years has gone to the Citizens Utility Board, or CUB. Nor did the governor cut in half a fund for parties that intervene in rate cases. He also did not introduce a plan to make CUB and other groups pay half the cost of expert witnesses. Instead, the legislature's Joint Finance Committee suddenly made the changes on April 15th, with committee co-chair Senator Alberta Darling blaming CUB for driving up utility costs.
We're talking about the cost of doing business in Wisconsin.
Critics shot back that Darling and her Republican colleagues were doing the bidding of Gail Klappa, the head of the state's largest utility, We Energies. Klappa's also on the board of the Metro Milwaukee Association of Commerce, or MMAC. But a We Energies spokeswoman directed us to MMAC lobbyist Steve Boss, who says he's the instigator.
You're looking at who was behind it. MMAC was the one who worked this motion through finance.
Regardless of who pushed the measure through, longtime dues-paying members of the Citizens Utility Board say ratepayers are the ones who will eventually foot the bill if CUB and other customer groups are weakened. Milwaukee resident Roger Oldenburg starts his microwave oven to warm water for his instant coffee. Oldenburg says CUB has saved him a lot of money over the last 35 years by convincing the State Public Service Commission to hold down the size of utility rate hikes. Oldenburg says hurting CUB would harm residential and small business customers.
Where you're dealing with multi-mega corporations that have millions and millions of dollars to spend on attorneys and presentations and lobbying and all of that. We need somebody that's actually going to speak on behalf of the little person.
CUB Executive Director Kira Lair says some of the utility's cash in rate cases comes from ratepayer dollars. She says that's ironic given some utility executives' salaries.
Mr. Klappa is making about $10 million a year now, which would fund CUB for 20 years to provide advocacy to save ratepayers millions of dollars.
Lair says state taxpayers wouldn't save any money if the grants and funds for those who challenge utility rate cases are cut. She says CUB can't go out and just raise more cash because that model has not worked elsewhere.
There you go.
At her home in Waukesha, another longtime CUB member, Pearl Schwanz, looks through her refrigerator. She says she and her husband already do their part to hold down electricity and heating bills.
I turn off the lights when I leave a room. I don't run the radio all day long. We holler at the teenagers to not take such long showers.
But Schwanz says she needs CUB to be a strong partner before the PSC. So she's appealing to the governor to reverse the proposed cuts.
Put it back in, Governor Walker.
Asked specifically last Saturday about Joint Finance's cut for CUB, the governor did not show his hand.
We'll be in extensively on Thursday going through what's likely to make it through the Assembly and the Senate to make a decision about what our line item vetoes are going to be.
In other words, utility ratepayers may know by this weekend the fate of customer groups like CUB. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.